ourselves.
Disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. Also, you can find out more about us and the work that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Where were you? A question that was originally attributed to the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy in 1963. They say everyone in the United States knew where they were when they heard the news. The news that reverberated across the United States and beyond. Eventually, this question, or expression really, would re-enter the American psyche and attach itself to another national catastrophe. A generation-defining event, which we are going to talk about tonight. Where were you? Originally, the site of the World Trade Center was part of the Hudson River, with the shoreline located approximately where Greenwich Street is today. In the year 1613, Dutch explorer Adrian Bloch and his crew were forced to abandon their ship the Tiger when it burned to the waterline, and the stranded men then began the first European settlement in the area, pretty much out of necessity due to being stranded. The rest of the wreck sank to the riverbed and was buried and lost to time when expansion of the Manhattan shoreline began in 1797. It wouldn't be rediscovered until 1916, almost a century later. Another 18th century ship was discovered in 2010 during the excavation of the former World Trade Center site, around 20 feet from the surface, and was believed to be a Hudson River sloop. Fast forward to the 1900s, and the World Trade Center location was part of New York City's Radio Row, a warehouse district mainly consisting of electronics, manufacturing, and repair firms, to which the main product of the time was pretty obviously radios. The center of the district was at the intersection of Cortland and Greenwich Streets, and flowed out from there. More than 50 individual radio shops occupied this relatively tight, compact area. The area of Radio Row is largely credited to have been from 1921 until construction of the World Trade Center began in 1966. Due to World War II and the affiliated parts shortages required for the radios, this was a significant era for the district and the beginning of its slow demise. The idea that eventually evolved into the World Trade Center came about in 1943, when the New York State Legislature passed a bill that gave New York Governor Thomas Dewey full authority to develop plans for a project that would further stimulate economic development in certain parts of Manhattan. No immediate action was taken, and eventually the plans were officially put on hold in 1949. David Rockefeller, the grandson of oil magnate John D. Rockefeller, was a notable business person in the New York circles of power, and was working with Chase Bank at the time following stints in the Department of Defense. Rockefeller had spent his first year after college working as an underpaid secretary to New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia, and according to the mayor, he essentially was filling the role of deputy mayor during his tenure there. When the idea for economic development re-emerged several years later, Rockefeller suggested placing a World Trade Center in the less developed Lower Manhattan to ignite economic activity within the area and for New York City as a whole. This would be the first project of its kind in the whole world. A World Trade Center would essentially be a place authorized by the WTC Association to promote and expand trade by providing services and assistance to firms and stimulating trade, mainly of an international nature. Basically, and in a nutshell, it's a really fancy name for government-owned office building. The New York and New Jersey Port Authority were now charged with developing the project and narrowed the site down to two choices: a location near the since-demolished Hudson Terminal, or near the South Street Seaport. The latter site was also along the East River and featured in its initial plans that were available to the public as a combined estate agency of New York and New Jersey. The Port Authority would need to seek approval from both states to move forward with their plans, however. Outspoken New Jersey Governor Robert Miner objected completely to New York receiving the entire $335 million project. That's $335 million in 1961 dollars, so the equivalent of around $3.4 billion today. Negotiations stalled between the two states as a result. Throughout the governor's, what we'll call, lame duck period in December 1961, the Port Authority began to meet with New Jersey Governor-elect Richard Harris in secret. The negotiations proved to be more fruitful, and the Port Authority agreed to move the proposed World Trade Center project from the East River location to the site located next to the Hudson Terminal. This move, as it would later be proven, would be easier for people from New Jersey to get back and forth from. In return, the Port Authority would take over the declining Hudson and Manhattan Railroad, which suffered from an 80% decrease in customers over the previous 30 years. Subsequently, it was renamed the Port Authority Trans-Hudson. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey now immediately began acquiring land in Radio Row through eminent domain law, giving each business a flat fee of $3,000 in 1965, or $34,500 today. A fairly measly offer even then. Actually, it wasn't even an offer. It was a forced purchase, which made the deal even worse for the property owners. But regardless of assets, the district was home to mostly commercial and industrial sites, and they were in significant opposition to the project. A court case was brought by several Radio Row businesses in the area, thus challenging the Port Authority's power of eminent domain, and slowly made its way up through the court system. The legal battle eventually ended when the Supreme Court refused to hear the case and dismissed the business owner's challenge. Land procurement was ultimately completed in 1965, and the demolition of Radio Row to make room for the World Trade Center began in March of 1966. It was completed by the year's end. Skipping back a few years, on September 20, 1962, the Port Authority had announced that Minoru Yamasaki would be the lead architect for the project, with Emery Roth and Sons acting as the associate architects. The largest constraint facing the design was the amount of office space that was required. Yamasaki suggested the idea of twin towers at the complex to meet the office space demand, suggesting that each tower could be 80 stories tall. But in order to meet the 10 million square feet needed, the towers had to be raised to 110 floors. Yamasaki's final design for the twin towers was released to the public on January 18, 1964. Each tower would be an exact square, measuring 208 feet in each direction and totaling almost an acre per floor. Yamasaki chose to showcase his fear of heights by using narrow 18-inch office windows in a display of irony, which, according to Yamasaki, would also help people in the building feel secure. His design was inspired by the architectural style of Swiss-French architect Le Corbusier, Gothic modernism and Arabic architecture, such as what he had just completed with a design for the Dharan International Airport in Saudi Arabia. Another significant aspect of the Twin Towers design was its elevators. Yamasaki and his team chose to use the relatively new Sky Lobby system that would utilize express elevators, which would take you to certain stations of the building, and then local elevators would take you to your floor from there. This design was opposed to the traditional elevator system, where each elevator went to all floors, but would have required significantly more of them. The Sky Lobby system allowed for 75% of the available floor space to be utilized, compared to 62% using the traditional system, and likely a further increase in floors to the structure. In total, 95 elevators would be needed for both towers. The design immediately received criticism from the American Institute of Architects, amongst others. Lewis Mumford, philosopher of technology and friend of Frank Lloyd Wright, wrote a significant criticism of the design in his book titled The Myth of the Machine. Specifically, Mumford said that the towers were just glass and metal filing cabinets and looked like the boxes that the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building had come in. After the project was finished, many of the building's occupiers complained about Yamasaki and his use of 18-inch windows. They provided little visibility or natural light given their depth, and the interior of the buildings had to be filled with unnatural lighting. After the design was completed, the project then went to Magnuson Clemensic Associates, who served as the structural engineering firm, with the Port Authority's engineering department serving as the foundational engineers. The firm came up with a formed tube structural system which removed columns of the core of the building and transferred lateral loads to the perimeter of the structure. As a result, the perimeter columns were placed very close together, which also contributed to the narrow 18-inch windows. While core columns still assisted with gravity loads, the building was much more dependent on its perimeter wall for structure and stability. This layout generally went against the common skyscraper design, where the core is the building's strength, with the floors essentially hung almost in suspension, in a display of central gravity strength. Coupled with several other factors, the exterior strength structured design specifically contributed to the building's collapse in 2001, following the compromise of the exterior walls. The frame tube system became very popular following the Twin Tower design, however, and almost all buildings over 40 stories are now constructed in this manner. Although post 9/11 buildings which have been constructed now also feature a robust concrete central core to decrease the structural reliance on the building's perimeter and offset the center of strength. While the Empire State Building, amongst others, used concrete around steel elements as fire retardant, which would dramatically increase the building's weight, the structural engineers of the Twin Towers used spray-on fire retardant over its internal beams instead. This, coupled with the decreased structural members in the core of the buildings, made the two towers significantly lighter and thus much more susceptible to sway. Ergo, engineers added viscoelastic dampeners to absorb the sways to a more tolerable level. The groundbreaking for the World Trade Center project took place on August 5, 1966, with most of the actual construction not beginning until 1968. Construction started on one World Trade Center first, with construction on two World Trade Center beginning 4 months later. Tishman Realty and Construction Company would serve as the general contractor for the project. Given the site's location and what was essentially a filled-in portion of the Hudson River, a bathtub-like structure had to be built around the site to keep groundwater out. Crews would dig down to bedrock for the tower's foundation, which was around 65 feet from the surface. This was 1/20th of the building's above-ground height. Once construction went vertical, the Port Authority spent over $74,000,965 on steel alone for the buildings. Construction heavily relied on prefabricated pieces built off-site, which would then be transported to the building location and lifted into place. The topping out ceremony, when the last beam was placed for One World Trade Center, occurred on December 23, 1972. And World Trade Center began accepting tenants ahead of time in January of 1972. The final ribbon cutting for the twin towers of the world's tallest buildings at the time occurred on April 4, 1973. The total cost for the structures came in at just over $900 million in 1970, or $7.1 billion in today's money. At the grand opening, One World Trade Center was officially the tallest building in the world, standing at 1,368 feet of usable space, surpassing the Empire State Building's 40-year run. Two World Trade Center came in its second tallest building when completed at 1,362 feet. The Twin Towers, coupled with the Sears Tower in Chicago, also had the most floors of any building in the world and would hold that record until construction of the Dubai landmark, the Burj Khalifa, in 2010. A year after the grand opening, French daredevil Philippe Petit crossed a high wire set between the North and South Towers, which was not authorized by the Port Authority. It took Petit 45 minutes to cross the 200-foot span, balancing himself more than 1,300 feet above the ground and with the wind pushing against his back. Petit was arrested and charged with criminal trespass and disorderly conduct, but was freed in exchange for performing for children in Central Park as a sort of community service. In 1975, Owen Quinn base jumped from the roof of the North Tower and safely landed on the plaza between the buildings below. Quinn stated that he had completed the parachute jump to bring mention and light to the plight of the poor. Whilst he was arrested by the Port Authority upon landing and forced to undergo two sets of psychiatric testing, after 19 court appearances that spanned just short of 12 months, all charges were eventually dropped. On Memorial Day in 1983, high-rise firefighting and rescue advocate Dan Goodwin successfully climbed the outside of the North Tower to bring attention to the inability to rescue people potentially trapped in the upper floors of the skyscrapers in the event of a fire or other similar disaster. Fun fact, the 1995 PCA Chess Championship was also played on the 107th floor of the South Tower. Other than the aforementioned complaints regarding the building's design, one of the other major concerns that quickly became apparent was the lack of restaurant and cafeteria space built into the complex for employees to use. This may seem like a small, almost insignificant problem, but for the most part, employees would have to leave the building and eat out for lunch. And given how there were around 25,000 inhabitants in each tower and an additional 20,000 visitors each per day on average, that's a lot of people shuffling in and out of the towers. There were skeptics and critics of the completed towers. In the final deal with the city, the Port Authority would make direct payments to the city instead of paying taxes for private tenants that would occupy leases within the buildings on a subsidized basis. Coupled with the existing vacancies in the private buildings, New York City real estate tycoons were appalled about the project, due to their view that the subsidized leases would dry up all the available tenants. The public was left out for any input in the design, and reaction to the complex was mainly negative in regards to the general public. The project was monolithic and overambitious in their view, opinion polls would suggest. Over the next decade or more, several smaller buildings were also constructed at the Superblock, which took the entire area between West Street, Church Street, Liberty, and Vesey Streets. 5 and 6 World Trade Centers were built alongside the Twin Towers, with 6 World Trade Center housing the U.S. Customs Service. 4 World Trade Center opened in 1975 and housed the U.S. Commodities Exchange. The final two structures would be completed in the 1980s. 3 World Trade Center opened as a 22-story Marriott Hotel in 1981, and the 47-story 7 World Trade Center would open in 1987. The 16-acre site also featured an underground shopping mall and both train and subway stations. It also housed one of the world's largest gold depository vaults. Between all of the buildings was the 5-acre Austin Tobin Plaza, named in 1982 after the Port Authority's chairman at the time of construction. The plaza could hold up to 6,000 occupants for summer concerts. But due to the Venturi effect created by the buildings and the large statue in the middle of the plaza, the location wasn't the most ideal concert venue. The plaza actually went under a $12 million renovation in 1999. 2 World Trade Center had an indoor observation deck called the Top of the World on the 107th floor that had widened windows topping 28 inches that allowed views over Manhattan and the Hudson River at a height of 1,310 feet. The Port Authority renovated the space and leased it to the Ogden Entertainment Group in 1995. Several attractions were added to the observation deck, including a movie theater that would showcase a helicopter tour around the city. It also housed Esparo and Nathan's famous hot dog restaurants. Visitors could also travel up via escalators to an outdoor observation deck at a height of 1,377 feet. It is featured in the movie Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, if you'd like to see what it looked like, or the view from up there. Another fun fact, it's also the location that I experienced my first ever panic attack and realized I have an intense fear of heights. Yeah, anyway, on a clear day, visibility was estimated to be around 50 miles. The design of the deck meant that the view was unobstructed, which made it more popular when compared to the observation deck of the Empire State Building, for example, which had an obstructed view. In one World Trade Center, instead of an observation deck, the space housed the windows of the World Restaurant on the 106th and 107th floors. Restaurateur Joe Baum opened the restaurant in 1976 at a cost of $17 million. The restaurant featured two offshoots in addition to the main course. One was a Danish smorgasbord and sushi cafe, and the other was Cellar in the Sky, a wine bar and wine school. The offshoots would change names after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the subsequent renovations. They became The Greatest Power on Earth and Wild Blue, respectively. In 2000, the restaurant reported $37 million in revenue, making the Windows of the World the highest grossing restaurant in the United States. Despite the restaurant's great success, the 1990s would end up being the final decade for the Towers, and unfortunately, the decade served a series of tragic events. As mentioned, in 1993, the World Trade Center bombing on February the 26th had been the most significant event at that point of the Towers. Ramzi Youssef, a Pakistani terrorist, parked a rented Ryder truck in an underground parking garage of the North Tower, which contained around 1,500 pounds of explosives. At 12:17 p.m., the explosives were detonated, which opened a five-story hole in the North Tower, causing significant structural damage. Six people were killed, and 1,042 were injured, mainly due to smoke inhalation. Five individuals in total were convicted for involvement in the bombing, with Youssef and his accomplice, Aid Ismail, convicted for carrying it out. Youssef was not a member of Al-Qaeda or any other known terrorist organization, but in a strange coincidence, Youssef's uncle is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks. It would later be determined that the conspirators' plan was to destabilize both towers enough to bring them both crashing down, but this was ultimately unsuccessful. Several important systems for the towers were destroyed in the blast, including the refrigerant system of the building's air conditioning. The underground gold depository was also damaged. After the bombing, security was heavily increased at the complex, including mandatory security checks for access to the South Tower's observation deck. A reflecting pool was erected to honor the victims who died from the attack. Despite the fanfare the New York government and Port Authority had for the complex, the private sector's excitement had never equalized or really taken off. The Twin Towers would suffer high vacancy rates for most of their lifespan and didn't achieve full occupancy until the year 2000. In the late 1990s, the Port Authority sought to lease the complex to a private firm to add the whole site to city tax rolls and provide funds for other Port Authority projects. After several years of sorting through bids, it was announced on February the 13th, 2001, that Vornado Realty Trust was successful in winning the lease for the entire World Trade Center site, thus fully privatizing it at a cost of $3.25 billion for a 99-year lease period. However, Vornado then insisted on last-minute changes to the agreement, including shortening the lease term, which was a non-negotiable for the Port Authority. So the deal was dropped, and the slightly lower offer of $3.22 billion from Silverstein Properties eventually won the final bid. The deal was closed on July the 24th, 2001. It really can't be stated just how significant this agreement would go on to become after the upcoming subsequent events. Little did Silverstein Properties, or anyone else for that matter, know that less than 6 weeks later, the mediocre yet iconic Twin Towers would become one of the most well-known and most talked about places on Earth, and would thus change the course of American history. Now, if you weren't alive during the latter half of the 20th century, it's hard to explain the amalgamation of factors that contributed to fierce tensions between certain parts of the Middle East and the United States. Throughout that time period, the United States had been involved in several conflicts in the Middle Eastern region and continued to maintain a large military presence after these conflicts were over. The United States and its imperialistic actions weren't always welcomed in that part of the world, so the sentiment went. Some of the examples of the United States' constant presence in the Middle East includes their leadership in the formation of the State of Israel, the coup d'etat and installation of the United States-friendly Shah of Iran in 1979, their cozy relationship and military base installations in Saudi Arabia, and also its large military presence after the Gulf War of 1991. Due to these and many other events in which the United States carried out in that region, several terrorist organizations and individuals with fundamentalist and radical Islamist ideologies emerged with major grievances against the United States and its allies. Any Western support of regimes in the Middle East, particularly from the United States, was seen by the population as aggression against Muslims. In 1979, a 22-year-old man by the name of Osama bin Laden left King Abdulaziz University after spending several years studying economics and business administration. During his time at university, he grew and developed an understanding and passion for the Sunni Islamic religion, becoming a devout and radical follower. Upon leaving university, bin Laden went to aid Abdullah Azam, who he had met at university, and contributed to the fight against insurgent groups, the Soviet Union, and the Afghan government. Bin Laden was the son of billionaire construction magnate from Saudi Arabia, and he brought money, machinery, and urgent aid to the fighting. The United States aided insurgent groups through the CIA and provided weapons, training, and other resources. The United States supported the insurgent groups because of their efforts to keep out communist influences of the Soviet Union in the region. The insurgent groups the United States supported ended up being the precursor to what we know today as Al-Qaeda. The US support, however, did not change bin Laden's opinion of US intervention in the Middle East, and whilst bin Laden and his group gladly accepted weapons and training from the United States, their hatred of the country and its ideals remained. More than two decades later, bin Laden was exiled from his birth country for ongoing vocal opposition to the presence of the United States and Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden thought the US was turning the Middle East into American colonies and that the US was going to destroy the Islamic holy sites of Medina and Mecca. Bin Laden was also strongly opposed to the Americanization of the region, intent on keeping out all aspects of American culture, media, and businesses. Bin Laden's own family would disown him and cut off his $7 million per year annual stipend. Following this, bin Laden moved around a bit as other countries debated exiling him due to his radical beliefs, eventually leading Osama bin Laden back to Afghanistan. It was at this point that US intelligence agencies began placing surveillance mechanisms to track bin Laden and his group members and paying close eye on what he was working on. US intelligence photographed and recorded video of his various activities, monitored his daily movements, and recorded all electronic communication involving him. Bin Laden, with his remaining funds, invested in various businesses to earn more cash flow and began building various construction projects throughout Afghanistan. He briefly had a job with a British company by the name of Hunting Aero Surveys. But guess what? He left this position due to a conflict of interest regarding religion and culture. Al-Qaeda, as a terrorist organization, was quickly growing during this time in the late 80s and early 90s, with bin Laden having constructed several training camps for the group in order to maintain and train militants, particularly sharing the American military training that had been given to them back in the mid-80s by the CIA. The group conducted several terrorist attacks throughout several Muslim countries, but ultimately bin Laden wanted to take the fight to the American lands in what he saw as revenge. It wasn't until a 1990 FBI raid of a suspected Al-Qaeda affiliate's home in New Jersey that the US intelligence learned of plans the group had to carry out terrorist attacks in the United States mainland. Due to this new information, US intelligence took the threat of Al-Qaeda even more seriously. Throughout the 1990s, Al-Qaeda carried out regular attacks in the Middle East, Europe, and Africa. In 1996, Osama bin Laden officially declared war on the United States of America, citing the continuing presence of the US military in the Middle East after the Gulf War. It was after this declaration that it is believed the planning for the September 11 attacks began. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is believed to have conceived the idea for the plot. Bin Laden then gave approval for Mohammed to go ahead and begin planning the specifics of the attacks. Planning meetings continued from 1998 into 1999, involving the two men and bin Laden's deputy, Mohammed Atef, who provided operational and logistical guidance. Atef wanted to also attack the US bank tower in Los Angeles, but bin Laden dismissed this idea due to lack of time. Bin Laden provided the financial resources for the plot and selected the participants himself. The original men, selected and sent to the United States to take flying lessons in San Diego, spoke little English and performed poorly in their lessons. Bin Laden then sent new Al-Qaeda recruits from Hamburg, Germany, who all spoke English really well, and one of them already had a commercial pilot's license. This has to make you wonder why these recruits weren't chosen in the first place. But throughout the year 2000, the men arrived in the United States and took flying lessons at Huffman Aviation in South Florida, with the previously selected group of men now acting as assistants to the new crew. The men were issued with fake and fraudulent passports from Saudi Arabian officials and subsequently gained entry into the United States under the radar. Ramzi bin al-Shib applied many times for a visa to the United States, but was rejected because as a Yemeni citizen, it was feared that he may overstay his visa, so instead, he helped with the attacks remotely from Germany. Bin Laden and the group selected September 11, 2001 as the date for the attacks to take place, because that was when John Sobieski III, the King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania, began the battle which turned back the Ottoman Empire's Muslim armies that were attempting to capture Vienna on September 11, 1683. Bin Laden saw this as the first instance of Western dominance over Islam. By 2001, the CIA had an entire unit dedicated to tracking and following Bin Laden's activities. It was named Alex Station. The NSA had also intercepted multiple calls the men made to schedule meetings, and they feared something malicious was going to happen, but they took no action. Further, Saudi Arabian intelligence warned the United States about the presence of Al-Qaeda members in their country, and the CIA went as far as to break into Khalid al-Midar's hotel room in Dubai and discovered that he had a US visa. The CIA's Alex Station notified intelligence agencies around the globe of this fact, but for some reason, they left out the FBI. Side note, I think we all know why. By late June 2001, the CIA knew that at least two Al-Qaeda members were in the United States and were absolutely certain that some sort of significant attack was about to take place. The CIA originally thought the attack would be in Saudi Arabia or Israel, which seems ludicrous now looking back and knowing what they knew at the time. Richard Clark and George Tenet of the CIA were especially concerned, and Clark put all domestic agencies on full alert and advised that the Defense Department go to Threat Condition Delta. The FBI had found out through investigations that suspicious activity had been going on at civil aviation universities and that there was substantial evidence that Osama bin Laden had planned a coordinated effort to send students to aviation schools across the United States. Kenneth Williams, an FBI agent based out of Phoenix, Arizona, sent a message to FBI headquarters, Alex Station, and the FBI office in New York with his information and said that all flight school managers need to be interviewed ASAP and identify all students of Arab descent seeking flight training. But despite both the CIA and FBI intelligence, the walls of bureaucracy that separate intelligence and criminal investigations, coupled with the secrecy of the methods of the CIA and NSA, are ultimately what prevented the crucial information alluding to the 9/11 attacks from being brought together. On August 6, 2001, President George W. Bush received a presidential daily briefing which was titled, quote, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike the United States," unquote. The report showcased some of the patterns of suspicious activity, but allegedly did not stand out amongst other reports of potential hijackings or attacks. It's unclear whether any further action was enabled from there, although it's widely considered to be none. The upcoming attacks would have little to no opposition from the United States intelligence or armed forces before being carried out just 1 month later. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, polls opened for the New York City municipal elections. U.S. President George W. Bush was at Longboat Key, Florida, where he was promoting his education agenda at Emma E. Brooker Elementary School and listening to young students read him The Pet Goat by Siegfried Engelmann. Earlier that morning, he went for a jog around the Colony Resort where he had spent the night, which was around 30 minutes after the hijackers got on their first flights before reaching their intended connections. Just before 8 a.m. that morning, all of the hijackers had checked in for their targeted flights at their assigned airports on the East Coast. And the various crews called each other from the terminals to confirm that the plans were set. At 7:59 a.m., American Airlines Flight 11 took off 14 minutes late from Gate B-32 at Logan International Airport in Boston, bound for Los Angeles with 81 passengers and 11 crew members on board the Boeing 767 aircraft. At 8:14 a.m., United Airlines Flight 175 also took off 14 minutes late from Gate C-19 at Logan International Airport, also heading to Los Angeles, with 56 passengers and 9 crew members aboard the Boeing 767 aircraft. At the same time, Flight 11 was hijacked over central Massachusetts and began turning northwest, then south. At 8:20 a.m., American Airlines Flight 77 took off 10 minutes late from Dulles International Airport in Fairfax County, Virginia. It was set for Los Angeles with 58 passengers and 6 crew members on board the Boeing 757 aircraft. At this time, Flight 11, which was now being flown by Mohammed Atta, begins to send transmissions out, with Atta saying, quote, "Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll just endanger yourself and the aeroplane. Just stay quiet," end quote. Betty Ong, a flight attendant on board Flight 11, then calls American Airlines Flight Reservation Center in Cary, North Carolina, describing the horrific scene on the plane during the hijacking. Given the suspicious radio transmissions and the flight attendant call, two F-15 fighter jets are sent from Otis National Guard Base on Long Island to intercept Flight 11. The final plane involved in the attacks departed at 8:42 a.m. United Airlines Flight 93 took off 42 minutes late from Gate 17 at Newark International Airport, bound for San Francisco. It had 37 passengers and 7 crew members on board the Boeing 757 aircraft. At this time, Flight 175 is hijacked above northwest New Jersey, 60 miles from New York City, and continues southwest before turning northeast. Complete horror would strike only a few minutes later as hijacked Flight 11 reached its intended target, crashing into One World Trade Center between floors 93 and 99, with all elevator shafts and staircases cut off by the impact. As the events of the day quickly came to unfold, it wouldn't be much longer until the motion of the whole world would come to a complete stop. At 8:50 a.m., Flight 77 flying above southern Ohio is hijacked and turns towards the southeast. Then, only 15 minutes after the first plane crashed into the North Tower, Flight 175 crashed into the southern facing side of the South Tower between floors 77 and 85, with parts of the plane exiting on all sides of the building and falling to the ground as far as 6 blocks away. As the Northeast was quickly becoming a war zone, President Bush, who is still in Sarasota, Florida, listening to elementary school children read to him, is briefly interrupted by Chief of Staff Andrew Card, who whispers into Bush's ear, quote, "A second plane has hit the second tower. America is under attack, sir," unquote. Bush then continued to read the book with the students, visibly shocked and wondering how to react. Moments later, after the pet goat's cliffhanger ending, President Bush enters the adjacent classroom to a command center, which has quickly been set up by the Secret Service to further evaluate the situation. Bush later stated that he opted to continue the lesson instead of alarming the students. At 9:28 a.m., the final plane, Flight 93, is hijacked over northern Ohio. It turns towards the northeast in the direction of Washington, D.C. The White House is immediately evacuated. But just a few moments later, Flight 77 crashes into the west side of the Pentagon, starting a violent fire within the building. The FAA issues an order to shut down all U.S. airspace, and all aircraft are ordered to immediately land at the nearest airport. A significant and unprecedented order that causes huge disruption and chaos at airports across the continental United States. Shortly before 10 a.m., passengers and crew begin to revolt against the hijackers on Flight 93, fighting to take back the plane after hearing about the other hijackings. 6 minutes after revolting, the plane is intentionally crashed by the hijackers in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. It would later be determined that the flight's destination was either the U.S. Capitol building or the White House. The world then watched as the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed just an hour after impact. President Bush quickly departed Sarasota, Florida, aboard Air Force One, with the intended destination still undecided. Within less than 30 minutes, and without knowing exactly what was happening, Prime Minister Tony Blair of the United Kingdom contacted President Bush aboard Air Force One and told him, quote, "No matter what happens today or in the coming weeks, Great Britain will stand with the United States no matter what," unquote. 30 minutes later, the North Tower of the World Trade Center also collapses, in addition to three World Trade Center. By the end of the morning, all air traffic in North America was shut down, and at 5:20 p.m., World Trade Center 7 also collapses, leaving 4, 5, and 6 World Trade Centers standing, but severely damaged. The motion of America and the world had come to a complete stop. Americans were overcome with emotion and shock at the unprecedented event that they had just witnessed. Fleets of fire trucks, ambulances, and police cars had arrived on the scene at the now former World Trade Center site to begin the rescue operation for any people trapped within the rubble. Volunteers immediately began digging, but only 20 people would be found alive among the scattered remains of the Twin Towers. 14 people who had managed to get to an emergency stairwell and luckily survived the collapse of the North Tower were 12 firefighters and 2 civilians who were able to climb the stairs to the top of the rubble field. When all was finally tallied up, 2,996 people died from the attacks, including all the passengers and crew of the aircrafts, the people trapped in the towers and the Pentagon, over 40 first responders and the 19 hijackers involved in the attacks. Only 1,600 of the bodies would ever be identified. The 19 hijackers are left out of most of the death totals and were excluded from receiving death certificates by the United States. More than 25,000 people would be reported injured. Media estimated that as many as 50,000 people could have been trapped in the towers by the plane crashes. However, official estimates more accurately determined that 17,400 people were inside the buildings at the time of the impacts. That night at 8:30 p.m., President Bush addressed the nation and the world. He said, quote, "Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundations of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve," unquote. It was apparently very obvious by nearly all Americans that the attacks were orchestrated by Osama bin Laden, with the media laying blame at his feet almost immediately. Bin Laden publicly denounced any responsibility for the attack, although he would later change this and admit full responsibility in 2004. Despite bin Laden being a wanted man by the United States since the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings in Africa, it would be almost 10 years before special forces tracked down bin Laden in Pakistan and executed him in a raid on his home compound. The remaining buildings of the World Trade Center that were left standing were completely demolished soon after the attacks. The Deutsche Bank building across the street was also condemned because of the toxic conditions inside, and the building was later deconstructed. In total, it took 8 months to clear up the entire World Trade Center site. A 2006 study estimated that the Twin Towers had appeared in 472 films and television shows, many of which subsequently pulled episodes or removed scenes featuring the towers, and all songs that talked about the World Trade Center were pulled from the radio. The events dramatically changed the way America and the world traveled and lived their everyday lives. The United States and its allies began a decade-long war in various Middle East nations, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, as a direct result of the September 11 attacks. The Twin Towers were already very well-known pieces of architecture and iconic structures before the 9/11 attacks. The World Trade Center, originally a beacon of trade and commerce, ended up a dark reminder of just how fragile freedom is. It left a scar on the psyche of everyone in the United States. Following the September 11 attacks, many conspiracy theories sprang up, and many Americans believe that there is more to the events of that day than the public are being told. Theories such as explosives being planted in the buildings by unknown US agencies and then detonated, explosive devices fitted to the planes that crashed into the towers, how the towers could not possibly have collapsed by being hit by planes alone, how the CIA planned the attacks with the Bush administration to justify going to war in Iraq for oil, that government insiders were aware of the attacks ahead of time, and how that is evidenced by multiple secretive sources placing various put options on the New York Stock Exchange prior to the attacks and making a small fortune following the attacks. How no airplane actually hit the Pentagon and that it was actually a missile. How the Pakistan government secretly funded the attacks. How Israel had advance warning of the attacks but did nothing in the hope that the US would retaliate against its enemies. I could go on and on. There are many, many theories out there. If you are interested in details of the conspiracies, actually, I recommend you check out Loose Change, an independent movie made by filmmaker Dylan Avery in 2005. I think that covers most of them. For me, however, if you look deep into the evidence, data, and science, there just isn't any credible reasoning to confirm a conspiracy took place. At least, not one that is in line with the conventional theories. That said, what regularly seems to get overlooked in the official story of 9/11 and by conspiracies are this. First, 16 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabian citizens. Given how the United States directly targeted Afghanistan for the 9/11 attacks because bin Laden was living there at the time, why wasn't the same retaliation taken against Saudi Arabia? Hell, Osama bin Laden was from Saudi Arabia too. Also, who in the Saudi government provided the hijackers with fake passports that allowed them to enter the United States and carry out the attacks? Second, Pakistan is a major US ally and took part in the War on Terror. It's a leading recipient of US aid. In fact, between 2002 and 2013, Pakistan received $26 billion in economic and military aid from the United States. So why were they hiding Osama bin Laden? Why did they allow him residency? Third, the initial US government response. Why was Dick Cheney running the country on 9/11 while Bush was evacuated to safety in a nuclear bunker? Did this reveal too much about the inner workings of the presidency? Fourth and finally, just how intertwined are the Bush and bin Laden families? It's common knowledge that the families have worked together for decades and share business interests. But just how intertwined are they, and what information isn't in the public domain? You see, once all flights in the United States had been grounded on 9/11, why did the Bush administration arrange for the whole of the bin Laden family in the United States to be evacuated to Saudi Arabia? For me, these are the most interesting unanswered questions that emerge from that event. But I suspect we'll never get those answers.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.